the town, the name of the town was Janiški. Janiški.
Which was in Lithuania.
It was in Lithuania. And it was a very tiny little town. And as soon as people were old enough, they wanted to settle someplace else. They wanted to find a future. The men, especially, had to get away, because if they didn't get away, they would have to serve in the Russian army, which was compulsory. And it was bad for everyone, but especially for Jewish people, it was certain death. So they had to either...
This is a ghetto, right?
It wasn't. No, it wasn't a ghetto. It was a little town where everyone made a living between themselves. You sort of, you bartered. I'll give you vegetables or fruit, and you'll give me dairy products. Or I'll give you baked goods, and you'll give me shoes, fix my shoes.
Well, now these are, this is your mother and father.
My mother and father, originally. I don't know where originally they lived, but when I was born, after I was born, we lived in this little town.
Did you know any of your grandparents or anything?
My grandmother came here. She came here. She died in Baltimore. Her name was Yetta. Rosenthal. Rosenthal. Yetta Rosenthal. And she came here after one of my mother's sisters came to Lynchburg. And she was terribly homesick and sent for her mother. And my grandmother came, and she lived here quite a while, and she died, and she was buried in Baltimore.
Now, your father's family, you didn't know at all?
My father's family, I didn't know, because most of them had gone to South Africa, way back, even before I was born. But I know my father, when I do remember him talking, and don't forget, I was 4 years old when he died. But my mother, after that, talked about a brother of his who had invented a horseless carriage in Riga, which was a very rare thing, actually. It was supposedly run on gasoline or oil or something, and it was a big feat at that time. It was a tremendous occasion. And he used to be very proud of that, you know, that his brother had this brains to invent it. Most of his family, however, have gone to South Africa, and there's still a lot of them there.
So when Uncle Morris went there, this was a logical thing for him to do.
Right. Uncle Morris was sponsored by my father's sister, Tilly Feinzinger, and her husband. Tilly Feinzinger and her husband came to Krugersdorp about 70 years ago, when the town was just being established. In fact, they are the first couple who were buried on that cemetery that they had gotten, in the new one. As a matter of fact, when I was in Africa 10 years ago, they were having a bicentennial, and that was the founding of Krugersdorp. And your Uncle Morris was one of the founders of Krugersdorp. He was in the building line, and he built a lot of government buildings. In fact, his name was on the foundation, sort of, built in this year by Morris Glavansky. And
so he left before even...
He left when I was 3 years old. And he left because he also had to go into the army. And he was sponsored by my father's sister, Tilly Feinzinger, who brought him there. And then her whole family remained there. She had children and grandchildren. And my father has, even to this day, nieces and nephews
in
South Africa.
So when my father was the next to go, he was the next up for the army.
He was next up, and he was sponsored by my uncle in Lynchburg, Virginia.
Your mother's brother?
My mother's brother. And he was sponsored there. And he came to Lynchburg, Virginia, and started going to school. And he also worked as a tinsmith in the day, until the day he fell off this.
But he didn't come to New York, he went to...
No, Lynchburg, Virginia, immediately. That's where he settled, Lynchburg, Virginia. And during the war years, the First World War, he went to Hopewell, Virginia, and he went from place to place, and he tried to establish himself. At that time, he had a pool parlor, he had a bakery at one time. He had, so many different things, but nothing could be insured because it was a town that sprang up overnight. They manufactured ammunition there.
Oh, is that?
Right, and so my mother told him, if you can't get insurance, your business isn't worth anything. So try to sell out and move into a more substantial place. And that's when he went to Baltimore.
Well, didn't he work for Joe Rosenberg for a while?
For a little while, just about a year.
When he first came
in the liquor business. In the liquor business.
Was he Tin Smith first, or was
Tin Smith first? And then when he fell off the roof, I told you the story. Yeah. He had to pick up his coat, and when the foreman said, "Why don't you yell down to me?" I would have picked it up. He said, "I couldn't yell down. I was in the coat." So he did that, and after that, he gave it up because he couldn't have done it even if he wanted to. He probably broke it because it lit wrong. He never could lift it right.
Yeah.
Then he went with Joe Rosenberg, and they didn't have a good rapport. They didn't get along too well. In the liquor business.
Yeah.
And then he went to Lynchburg and opened one place, a billiard parlor at one time, a bakery.
These were all in Lynchburg.
All in Lynchburg.
Yeah.
All in Hopewell.
Hopewell.
Not in Lynchburg, in Hopewell. And then he came on to Baltimore.
And Baltimore, what did he do?
He opened a pawn shop immediately. Immediately.
Yeah. That was 1918.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Now, how do you go back a little bit with your. When he first came over here. I'm just trying to figure. And he brought. You people came over the rest
now,
of the
time. Now, wait. He came here first.
And what was it, 1907?
1907. And when he was here 1 year. No, he was here longer than a year. And Fanny came in 1912. He brought Aunt Fanny over and one of his girlfriends. He had been sort of semi-engaged, and he promised this girl that one day he'll bring her over. But he was only 18 at the time, and she was only 18 at the time. And when she came over 2 years later, he had changed his mind. He,
no kidding.
Right. He didn't. He figured that wasn't for him. And it left a great impression in his entire life. He thought he did the wrong thing by bringing her over and by not marrying her. He thought that he had disappointed her and he shouldn't have done it. And I told him he was very wrong, because once he found he didn't love her anymore, it would have been worse. It was a crime to marry her, you know, and then probably be divorced. As it was, he was very truthful. He thought he liked her. He was only 18 when it happened. At 20 or 21, he changed his mind. So he brought Dora over with Aunt Fanny at the same time. And Fanny was here only about a year when Uncle Morris wrote from South Africa, "It's bad for a young girl to be alone, that we must try to join her." So he said he would help with as much as possible. And he did. And we all came. That was my mother and Ethel, Uncle Jack, and myself.
All in one fell swoop.
Right.
Yes.
We all came together. And we settled in Mount Vernon. And your father was already in Hopewell all this time. He was in Hopewell. We never saw him, but Uncle Jack lived home for a little while. And then about a year later, he went to work for your father. It was in Hopewell, Virginia, and then in Baltimore, Maryland.
Yeah, I knew Jack was in Baltimore.
Right, and then Baltimore, Maryland, until he was married. When he got married, he opened up a delicatessen store.
Remember
that. Now, what else do you want to
know? How, go back to where the relationship between your family and my mother's family seems to coincide.
It is not, it wasn't a, the relationship was not family, it was more or less friendly. My mother and your grandmother were girlfriends. And that's where it started, and that's where it ended. They were very good bosom girlfriends, lived in the same town for many, many years. And naturally, this was strengthened by the fact that your father married her daughter.
Yeah, plus her, there was a relationship between
Effie and Joe. There was from the other side. Joe was our relation, and Effie was on the other side from the father's relation.
I see.
You see, we were related to Joe on his mother's side. My mother and Joe's mother were sisters.
I see.
Joe's father and Effie's father were brothers.
Uh-huh.
So that's where the relationship came in. But actually, we didn't have a relationship. We had a friendship, a long friendship, because to the end of their days, they were friendly. They would remain girlfriends.
So that Molly Cantor?
Molly Cantor.
Was spending with your mother.
Right, right.
Yeah, I never knew that.
Right, right. They were very good friends.
Now, when you came, you lived in Mount Vernon.
In Mount Vernon, New York, right. And your father already lived in Lynchburg, Virginia, and then moved to Baltimore. We came here 6 months before the war. And all this going on in Hopewell, Virginia, was because of this town springing up because of the ammunition plant.
Yeah.
And the ammunition plant was in Hopewell, Virginia, and he thought he would go in and reap a little harvest there, which he did.
Because he worked
in the plant.
He made
money there, right. He made money, and he made money only from the people who worked the plant. He opened up for them what was necessary. It was a bakery and other things that they needed. And that's the way he, until the end of the war. And then when at the end of the war, he went to Baltimore and opened up a corn shop.
Nice. Now, how about you? When did you meet Uncle Ira?
I lived in Mount Vernon. My sister Fanny brought us to Mount Vernon. And we lived into an apartment. I was 10 years old. I went to school. And at 14, I graduated public school because I had started so late.
Yeah.
And then I went to high school at night and graduated from Mount Vernon High School.
Okay.
But I worked during the day. And at that time, we had a man who was living with us by the name of Dave Levine, who opened up a ice cream parlor. And Uncle Ira came to show him how to make. He had been a candy maker from Vienna. He had learned his trade in Vienna. Right, Vienna.
Yeah.
From Austria.
Yeah.
Right. So he used to work behind, in the back of the door, the back of the store, and I'd come in there and just help a little bit and get some ice cream or candy, whatever I wanted, and I'd go in the back, and that's where I met him. When I met him and he seemed friendly, I said to myself, gee, that's a good match for either and Fanny or Ethel. So I invited him to the house. When I invited him to the house, he started coming to the house. He told my mother about 6 months later, he doesn't want them, he wants me. And that's what happened.
Do you think that if things were different today, do you think that if you were born and grew up in this country today, would it be different for you? In other words, would people, were some of the marriages that we know arranged, a lot of them were arranged, really?
Not in my day.
No?
They were not arranged.
But earlier than you.
As far as that's concerned, Ginny, for that matter, it's being arranged now because Jeanette, while she was in the hospital now, she was in the same room with the Hasidic woman who had the same type of operation. And she showed her pictures of her 20-year-old son and his bride, who had never met till the day that they were engaged. They told him this week, they looked around for her. Her husband and her were looking around for a girl for 2 years. He's only 20 now.
Yeah.
And they finally found this girl whom they thought would make him a wonderful wife. And they told him, you are going to be engaged when you're 20, and we've picked a girl for you, and we know you like her. And when they met, they liked each other. And that was that, and they're getting married. Now, that's this day and age.
Yeah, of course, that's not.
In my day and age, it wasn't like that anymore.
It was
already gone.
But the Europeans, of course...
Long ago, many years ago, many, many years ago, before, well, I should say, in the 17th century, right? In the 17th century, parents did arrange marriages for their children.
How about in the town that you lived in, a little town?
In the little town where I lived. You see, we were called, by the religious people, we were called, what they called Salem Kip, cross. They say they saw a cross on our foreheads because we weren't religious enough for them. We were already...
conservative.
We were already liberated. We were liberated Jews. In other words, a lot of people didn't have to keep kosher anymore. Most of them did, but a lot of people didn't.
Didn't keep kosher?
That's right.
Did you keep kosher
in our town? Oh, yes.
Yeah.
My mother was very religious.
Yeah.
My brother was a rabbi. He was sent away at a very early age to study in a place called Slobodka.
Slobodka, this is
right.
Now, how come he didn't have to go to the army? He wouldn't have had to go.
No, he didn't go. Because, first of all, you see, divinity, anybody connected with divinity didn't have to
even
go.
Even the Jews,
right.
Even the Jews couldn't
have to go. Right, right. But, and then, he was more or less a weaker person, and because he always sat and learned, he never developed his body like it should have been.
Mm.
He was never strong like, let's say, your father or Uncle Morris, who really did the physical labor,
right.
And he was probably, he couldn't pass the physical. At any rate, he became a rabbi at a very early age. He married a girl from Zesmer, which was another province. Someone had made a shidduch. Someone made a shidduch between my brother and this girl, whose name was Schaefer. And they were merchants in Zesmer. They had dry goods stores, a lot of stores, and they were wealthy people. And you had to marry a wealthy girl because otherwise you had no way of making
a
living.
As a student.
Yeah. And how long are you a student? For many, many years. Some people never get to earn any money. They just sit and learn. And this is the kind of thing that people know that they're take on when they take out a son-in-law.
Yeah.
So that there was a shadchan, And he sent word to us that there's a very nice girl, a wealthy girl, who was ready to get married. And my brother went out and saw her, and the thing took. And before you know it, he was married. He was married at 20.
Where, at 20.
Right.
Were you living then? What was this? What was the name of the town?
The name of my town was Yanishki. In Russian, it was called Yanishki. Yanishki. And the biggest city near it was Shabli, but it was in the Kovno province, in the province of Kovno, the Kovno state.
This was actually Lithuania, though.
Lithuania then, but now it isn't. Now it's Russia.
Oh, it is Russia.
Definitely. But we were mainly on the German border. We were closer to the German border than we were to the Russian border. And consequently, we didn't have to. The Tsar was our Tsar. He was our ruler. But we didn't have to pay any taxes towards him. We didn't have to adhere to his laws as much as the people living in Russia. We were not Russia. We were closer to the German border. Our language was Lithuanian, German.
Yeah, I know my father spoke German.
Yiddish, right? Yeah. Because we lived closer to the German border. People who live closer to the Russian border, their language automatically became Russian.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I went to school. I learned only Russian in school. And that was like a one-room schoolhouse. And first, second, and third grade were all in the same school, and I had to graduate three times because I had no other school to go to. So people would come from the county seat from Kovno and sort of give us an oral examination, and they would graduate us, and the next term I'd have to be back again.
You come back in a different grade.
Right. And I still remember my teacher's name. His name was Kusevitsky.
Oh, musician.
No, he wasn't.
Isn't that interesting? So when you left there,
it was just about beginning of Bolshevism, the beginning of it. And there was a lot of subversion going on amongst the young people, like every place else, you know. They always had meetings and underhanded meetings, and they had a lot of literature that they weren't supposed to read. And then when they saw this thing getting serious, they started to look, investigate, and search. And they would shoot a lot of people on sight when they found a lot of an overabundance of literature and subversive literature. And there was nothing to hear funerals going, you know, Jews and Gentiles, both young people. We had the biggest church around our area. It was a beautiful church, the only thing we had that was so beautiful. And those bells would peal all the time with these funerals, because towards the end, and towards my going, before I went away, I left there in 1914. And 1915, Bolshevism came in. Incidentally, do you know the meaning of Bolshevism?
No.
It comes from the word Bolshai, meaning big, the majority. And then when they finally won their Bolshevism, they finally won it over by revolution, not killing. It was like a bloodless revolution. That was before Trotsky, right before Trotsky and Lenin, if you remember. Then all the peasants got drunk, and they would just run wild. And my mother had to, she had to burn one. It was a soldier who had been ordered to leave, and he also ran wild and could get all they drank all they could get. And he came to my mother. We had an inn at that time. And he came to my mother and wanted whiskey. And my mother saw that he was already drunk. And by the window, it was a great big window, and she was boiling water to give Fanny a bath then. And he won't leave. And she took some water and poured it on him, and she burnt out his eyes.
Oh my God.
But she never was responsible for it, because a lot of people were doing the same thing, and there was a lot of murders going on because the people were running wild between the army and the Bolshevism. They didn't know which way to run. You know, it's just one of these things when you emancipate someone, you don't know what to do first. And this was like the beginning of it.
That they let you out as a prize. They
let us out. It was right 6 months before the war. So we came here in December. It was Christmas time. And during that year, 1914, the war broke out.
And you went right to Mount Vernon, that's right.
We went right to Mount Vernon. And we lived there a little while, and then Uncle Sir, and he saved up $1,000, and he sent it to my mother, and he says, "You keep it for me, but if you want to invest it in anything, I'll abide by it." So my mother bought a house. And that was her first venture into real estate. After that, she started dealing in real estate. How did she deal in real estate? She bought a house. And then we lived in it, and then someone offered her $1,000 or $2,000 profit. She would sell this and buy another one. And that's how we got, but before we moved to New York, we had our own house. We had a two-family house. By then, it was self-supporting.
Yeah.
And it got to a point that she became so knowledgeable about real estate that people took her as an expert. They would take her and to investigate the plumbing and the cellar. She'd go down the basement the first thing and see if it's dry. And then she would investigate. She was a remarkable woman.
Really remarkable.
I'm just thinking if she had an education, like a formal education, she would be a genius, because all of us, you know, always abide by, we would abide by what she would say, like your father. He was a big businessman.
Yeah.
But if his mother said, it's no good unless you get insurance, he said she was right. And as a matter of fact, any minute the town could have gone up in flames.
It did. Ultimately.
There you are.
That's when they made him the fire commissioner.
Right.
The town burned out, they made him the fire commissioner.
And my mother said, it's not worth anything if you can't get insurance.
How long did she live after she came to this country?
We came in 1914, and she died in 1927.
So it was long enough.
Yeah, 1927. But this is when she had it easy. She had a very hard life. When my father died, I was 4 years old. There were seven of us left. So Uncle Morris went on to South Africa, and then there were six left. Then your father came on to the United States, and we were five of us, but you still had to make a living. So, and Ethel used to help her bake. We used to make bagel. Did you know my mother made bagel? Oh, yes. This was her main product.
That's where my father learned how to bake.
Right. We made bagel, and she and Ethel would help her. And Uncle Jack and I would carry out the orders.
What? And home industries were part of the town at that point.
Home industries. There actually were no industries at all.
And
you either had a bakery like my mother, or else you had farm, or else you were a shoemaker, or else at the very end, a man ventured and opened up a dry fruit and condiment store. Everybody came to look at it. And, you know, he went to Riga and bought a bunch of bananas, and nobody knew what it was. And it hung and hung, and he tried to ask people to buy it. And then when it rotted already and was running already, people were buying it then. They thought it had to be that way, but they didn't know what to do with it, you know. I had never seen a tomato before I came here. I had never seen lettuce. An orange was a rare thing. When my mother went out of town, and she'd come back and want to bring us a present or a treat, she'd bring us an orange. But we had carrots and potatoes dug under the ground. You know, we would hide it for the whole, and onions. And cabbage.
What was your father doing with a farm? Didn't you find a farm?
My father, not a farm. We had a mill. We had like an inn, but we had to grind our own flour. And Uncle Morris would go to the mill and grind it. And that was the time I told you the story about my mother being pregnant and going at 12 o'clock at night to the mill, carrying the wheat to be ground. And a peasant had hung himself a week before him. When the horse came to the spot, he wouldn't budge. So my mother jumped off the wagon to help the horse across, you know, by the reins, and she miscarried. And she was all alone, 12 o'clock in the woods, and she just said she picked it up and put it in the wagon, and she came home. She just finished the job and came home. And that was the time when Aunt Gertie said, oh my goodness, which one of you was it?
That's one of the better stories. When you say he had an inn, was that a regular inn?
An inn to just, people yeah, sleep.
Kosher.
People come in, not kosher.
It wasn't.
There was nothing there but drinks. It was tea and beer and whiskey.
It was a bar.
A bar.
But you didn't stay overnight.
No. Yeah. Well, people could stay overnight.
Tavern,
we had like a tavern.
Yeah.
Tavern, but not. And this wasn't for long either. It wasn't for long. And this was in a farm in a place called Malden. This was before I was born. And then when I was about to be born, then we moved into the town.
Oh,
that was after my father died in Yanushki too. And that was that. But we didn't have anything for very long. It was just like periods.
Of your father or because of the way it was?
Because of the way it was. And my father was a sick man even from the time my mother married him. Mm. He had a few things that were wrong with him. And as a matter of fact, he died a young man.
Right.
Yes, he died very young. He was in his early 50s. But My father was a learned man. He was an ordained rabbi, which he never practiced, but they sort of made him the elder of the town. It was his job to take people into the bathhouse if they'd come in, like on a Friday, you know, if a stranger would go by the town and he'd want to stay someplace. My father would take him to the bathhouse and clean him up. My mother would have him there over Shabbos. But he was a very pious man. He used to just sit and learn with children and learn by himself.
And she actually, did all the work.
She did all the work. He was never strong enough to work. Never.
Yet my father didn't seem to have very good memories of him.
You mean as far as...
As a father?
He was too busy to give each one, special attention. I was a baby. So he hardly had a chance to talk to me. Don't forget that the conditions and situations were so bad then that everybody was poor. You could hardly get along. You barely had enough to eat. And who could you take it out on but your own children? You couldn't go and take it out on. You know, it was your misery and your frustrations. You had to let it out on somebody. So you figured you couldn't let it out on the girls.
No.
Everybody was undergrown, underprivileged, underfed, and most of us had to take care of ourselves. In fact, Uncle Shia used to tell me, he says, I was so delighted with you. When I came back from studying and I saw a big girl, I didn't have to diaper you, I didn't have to change you, I didn't have to take care of you. I was so happy with you. I really loved you because you were like a present. In other words, everybody had to pitch it and everybody had to do. Everybody had to
had responsibility.
Right. And this is the kind of life you had when you have seven children and nothing to feed them, and you don't know where your next meal is coming from. It makes it very difficult for you. Now I look back and I say to myself, they were really wonderful people. They tried to give you love, and then they couldn't. So they sort of appeared hard to you, and they appeared like they're just bearing children, just for the sake of bearing children. They're not giving you anything. But when you analyze it, and when you think of the hardship they had, they were brought up that way, and that's what they had to do.
It's probably true. They didn't
from
know
the
any.
Time they were able to walk, they had to help. All of us had chores to do. It wasn't a case where, even though I was only 10 when I came here, I must have been 7 or 8 when I was in Europe. I had to carry out those orders with the bagels, and sometimes it was so heavy under the weight of it I couldn't even carry it. I had to take it to the different restaurants and whatever they had, like the Gentile people had a lot of inns. And the main thing was the inn with people traveling back and forth. They had to have some place to stay. So when I carried out these bagels, it wasn't time for breakfast when they were serving breakfast. And my brother and I both, Jack and I, had to. And Jack was a little boy too. And then Ethel, who was a tiny little thing, we always thought it stunted her growth because she had to do this from the time she was 12 years old. Help my mother bake and stay up all night.
Where's
and when I think of the hardship my mother had, her hands were so worn out. She was worn out when she was 50. She looked like a woman of 90 now. And then my brother, when they asked him, my brother the rabbi, when they asked him to make a eulogy over her grave, he says, "I can't." He says, "But the only thing I will say is that she sold her shawl off her back so that I would have coffee to go to the city where I'm supposed to study." She said, "If you want to study and you want to be a rabbi and you want to do something, I'll dig the earth and I'll let you do it." And she did. She literally had to dig the earth to let him do it. And these things were hard. They were very, hardships.
Yeah.
One day I was walking to the bus and I saw a woman, a little bent over woman that resembled my mother. And she was holding the car fare in her hand. And I said to herself, it just almost broke my heart, exactly like my mother did. Her hands were careworn. And she would count out the receipts, the daily receipts of her bakings. And I'd say to her, "Mama, why don't we keep this?" She says, "I can't. I have to give him for the flour and I have to give him for the wood." And she would show me, her way of doing business. This had to go to this one and this had to go. And just a little tiny pile was left for herself from all her work. So that's the way it was.
When you say you bake bagels, is bagels a Jewish food or a Russian food?
It's probably both. Right.
Were they invented it here?
No. It was invented in Russia. In fact, in Russia, they call them bublichka. And bublichka is a very famous part, part of the menu there. This is bublichka, is bagel. Right.
heard the word butlichka.
Butlichka, that's in Russia, Russian orange. And people liked it. And, you know, you have to boil them first and then bake them. And that's what we did. We had a great big kettle. And my mother had a tremendous oven out of bricks. With those, with a big shovel, she would put in the, in the, those days, she would put in the, all the trays of bagel, and they would come out, and it was always hot, and she had a way of doing it which was so remarkable. She was so adept at it. It would go so fast. You would look into a basket, there was nothing there. Before you knew it, there were over 100 bagels.
Mm-hmm.
In just no time at all. With the very simplest implements, you didn't have anything electrical, you know,
no,
like they have today, you know. Everything was done coal stove.
Yeah.
And you know what? Her main interest in her whole life, she lived only for a pile of wood, which was piled up near in our backyard next to the cow, or the cow was next to that. And if a fire would start, she wouldn't budge, because that wood may burn. She would stand with a pail of water and pour it over, because she said if the wood is burning, that's her whole life. She may as well give up.
Oh, my God.
She used to say it.
And if you had given up, there was nothing. I mean, the government wouldn't take care of anything.
Oh, no.
The presence just died.
No. Right. You lived on what you were able to produce yourself with your own two hands. If we never needed anything. We had, we grew our vegetables, so we had our potatoes and our carrots and our little radishes, and we didn't have lettuce or tomatoes. We didn't have fruit of any kind. An apple we'd have. It would grow in the orchards.
Mm.
We had apple orchards.
Did you live next door to Gentile people? Were they intermingled?
No. We lived like in, we called it the marketplace. It was a tremendous open, like, it's now, as I think of it, like a cul-de-sac. You couldn't get out. You have to go up about only one way. And this marketplace was, everybody bought their wares once a week. And they would sell it.
Like in Rome.
Yeah.
And you would sell it. Everybody would bring their wares that they have, like their vegetables or dairy products or shoes. And I used to wear those long, it was terribly cold. You know, we had winter maybe 7 months out of a year. And we used to wear what they called volikas. Volikas were made of felt. It was a felt shoe that came up all the way, and you used to wear them inside of your shoe, or your children would wear it outside. This was the biggest item, and you always had to buy them. They weren't like boots here. We called them volikas, and volikas meant something made of wool. And this is what we wore, and this, we knew that every week, every Thursday was market day, and you only bought once a week. After that, finished. But we had our own cow, which gave us milk and cheese and butter, and buttermilk, and all the products that we could, you know, get out of it. My mother would make her own needles. So actually, we didn't have to buy anything. Bread and rolls, we had as much as we wanted. So the little meat or chicken that we had, we even raised chickens. We had eggs. It was like a little farm in a little tiny town. The whole idea was like an Anatevka in Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost exactly like
that's
that.
That's why everybody liked it.
Exactly, because this is the kind of thing that everybody remembers.
Well, when you came here, you came to the city.
Right, but when we were leaving there, they already had a bus that went with gasoline from Janishki to Shavli, to the county seat. Shavli was the county.
And they already had a bus.
And they were starting to go by bus there.
Well, when you came to America and you came to Mount Vernon, this would be, it was a suburb at the time.
But it was almost unapproachable. It would take you a long, long
Mount
time.
Vernon?
Mount Vernon from New York
was
a suburb.
That's what I'm saying.
We found a 36,000 population, and there were only about 400 Jewish families. And people were friendly with one another. In fact, the whole atmosphere was friendly. How did I start going to school? I was playing in the street. I came here when I was 10. I didn't know how to talk one word of English. A truant officer went by, and he asked me where I lived, and I didn't know how to answer him. And I pointed to the apartment right next door to her. There was a family who helped us, you know, who tried to speak for us. And Hochberg, their name was. In fact, my mother helped her put her in business later. So Mrs. Hochberg came in and explained to this man that we had just gotten here, and that I can't talk English, and that I didn't even know where to register or do anything. He said to come with him, he would register me, which he did. My luck was that I had a lot of German speaking teachers. And when they found that I couldn't speak one word of English, they kept me after school. And they would teach me from German to English, like Wasser, water.
Oh, because you knew German.
Yes, I knew German. So, consequently, I learned to speak English in about 5 months. I spoke fluently. And then when I started to learn to speak English, they started promoting me. You know, they started me in kindergarten. And then before I knew it, I was in the fourth grade. grade and the fifth grade, and I start skipping because arithmetic I knew. I didn't know the history, and I didn't know geography. I know my own history and geography. But I learned it. I got it. So I graduated at 14 instead of 13.
So that was very fast.
Right.
How about your brothers and sisters? None of them?
None of them went to school. No, they went to night school for a while, but nobody really had a formal education. I don't even think your father had a formal education.
No, he said he had eighth grade,
Eighth grade, that's right. That's right. But I knew I had to help out. I knew I couldn't. I was the youngest in the family, and my brothers and sisters were wonderful to me to help support me and everything. I thought, I can't do it, you know, forever. So I went to high school at night. I graduated high school, and then I went to a business school where I studied shorthand and typing. And I became a stenographer. I worked for many years. I used to work on 14th Street.
I remember you had worked somewhere.
Right.
Yeah,
14th Street.
Well, how about when you first came here, though, the life must have been different. I mean, after all,
it was different.
Not
it was different everywhere. It was different everywhere.
Are you used to this?
It was different in a way that, you mean from Europe, from the way we had it in Europe. It was and it wasn't, because we moved in where there were a lot of Jewish-speaking people, and my mother could converse with them, and I learned English in no time. I had a tremendous amount of friends there, and we immediately joined the YMHA, my brother Jack and I. And we were integrated fast, you know. It didn't take us any time at all. And I had absolutely no problem. I had a wonderful childhood. Not so my sister Ethel and Fanny. It was a little harder for them because they needed a different kind, a different element. And for years and years and years, people are a lot of flight, you know, who came from the same town, used to live in New York. They would travel to Mount Vernon because it was a suburb from New York. And they'd spend their weekends with us. That's the only association we had with people that we knew. We had lawns like everywhere. We had people that knew it.
That's why I'm asking how you got to Mount Vernon.
Right. Well, Mount Vernon, you see, at that time, when your father came here, he became very friendly with Barnard Schaefer. Barnard Schaefer was Aunt Rachel's brother, who was here. They became very friendly. And when we came on into this country, Barnard Schaefer came to meet us, to help your father, you know, to meet us. And he suggested to Aunt Fanny, he said, don't bring them into New York, into a big city. Look for a suburb. And Aunt Fanny had heard about Mount Vernon. In fact, she had lived there for a month and tried it out. She lived with a family by the name of Raymond. And they all said that it would be a marvelous thing if they brought us to Mount Vernon. I would have a better chance, and Jack would have a better chance than living in the big city.
Yeah.
And that's what she did. And that's how it happened, and we remained there. And as I said, in those days, the population was smaller, and everyone cared. It was such a wonderful relationship. Let me show you how different it was. When Jeanette was born, 42 years ago, and Fanny and her family lived in Mount Vernon. Now, Gertrude was a little girl then, so she came to school and said to the teacher, my aunt went to the hospital to buy a boy, but they were all out of boys, so she had to buy a girl. And the teacher thought it was so adorable, and she took her from class to class to tell the story. Now, they couldn't do a thing like that today.
No, it's
very impressive. Right. And as I said, everyone took a personal interest in you, like the principal, Mr. Grimes, took a personal interest in me. As a matter of fact, a lot of people took a personal interest in me. There was a certain rabbi by the name of Margolis who had a conservative synagogue. And when I came here, I had, you know, had quite a bit of Hebrew. At 10 years old, I had, I was quite advanced in Hebrew. And when I got into his school, he said to me, where did you learn your Hebrew? And I told him, in Europe. He said, why, when did you come from there? I said, only about 6 months ago. He said, you talk so well? I said, yes. So he taught me, he tutored me English. And he also said, and he took an interest in me, a great interest. His wife was an artist. And he took an interest in me for the longest time, until I was about 16. And then I was the first Jewish girl. My friend and I were the first Jewish girls in Mount Vernon to bob our hair.
Oh, my God.
The first Jewish girl.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Because you didn't do that, did it? The family was too restricted.
Right, but we took a chance, and we bobbed our hair, and he made a sermon about that. And he was very disappointed in me that I had bobbed my hair, because he expected such tremendous things.
That's interesting.
And travel.
How about the religious? Was your family religious? Over there.
Over there, we were very religious, and over here, too. And my mother was very religious, but my mother never imposed religion on us. She never said, you must be religious. We had a kosher home. We saw candles being lit every Friday. We never did anything on the Sabbath. But she never said to us, you must do so-and-so.
You had to go to temple.
Well, we did go. I went to the synagogue, and I'm an Orthodox and it's conservative, because I liked Rabbi Margolis, and I liked his services, and I sang in the choir. And I loved it, because it was interesting
to me.
So, as a result, I went Friday night and Saturday morning to the synagogue, and we sang with the choir. We had our own little box up there, and there were about 12 of us girls, and we had a great time. I loved it. I wouldn't miss it for anything.
Maybe I'm not
But it's true
but
that,
as far as my mother was concerned, she never imposed.
Yeah, I was going to say, because the rest of them were not that religious. The boys, for example, with the exception of she. I mean, I don't think Uncle Jack was religious.
Uncle Jack was not religious, and neither was your father.
My father was
he was religious in certain ways, but he never adhered to everything because you couldn't. He worked on the Sabbath, and once you work on the Sabbath, you can't adhere to religion like you want to. But with Uncle Shea, it was his way of life.
Yes, well, he was.
He did it because he knew that he was going to be a rabbi, and it like was his way of life. Like Myrna said to me one day, Myrna, which is Hillel's wife, she said to me, Aunt Shirley, I'm not to be gotten credit because I do certain things the way I'm doing them, and I don't do the things that I don't want to do on the Sabbath. She says, this is my way of life. This is I was raised for it. It's a different world, she said, but I don't deserve credit for it, and I want to be that way. And in a way, she was right.
Mm.
She was right. Everybody lives in a different world, Jimmy.
That's true.
Right?
That's true. But you see, the difference, the problem with that world is that that is a world that I suppose has to proselytize. I mean, that world is supposed to impose itself on your world. If you're not religious and you are friends with religious people who do this for a living, they're supposed to impose their world on you.
They don't.
Well, they should.
They don't.
I guess they should.
Right, right.
But it doesn't work.
Right. When we talk about religion, Jeannie, even she and his family are not that religious as the way I've seen people do, and I've seen people be religious. There are certain sects
of
religion.
Yeah, I think that's a different religion. Though.
That you and I could never even think about.
No, I think that's a different religion.
Now, these people, these same people, call a man like Israel, or a man like Uncle Shia, may rest in peace, they would call them apokorsim. Apokorsim means people who don't believe in anything, people who are atheists.
Yeah,
you see, that's how deep and how great it is. So there's all degrees of religion.
Yes, but that's true. So that's a different...
All degrees.
Yeah. It's just like to the
right. Now, as far as we're concerned, we're born into a certain... We are born into our Judaism. I practice it a little. You may not practice it at all. Your children will practice it even less than you do.
Yeah.
But they're still born Jews.
Right.
You can't... You cannot get away from it.
No.
We are Jews. We are not... We don't belong to probably the organized religion. It is a wonderful thing for every Jew to know his background, to know his history, to know...
Yeah, I agree with that.
Right. It's a marvelous thing because it gives you a certain sense of pride. It gives you a sense of belonging, and belonging to a race that has done great things. So great that some things are almost unbelievable. And we would be, you know, it gives you a certain sense of pride to know it. It's good to know it.
Yeah.
To know
religion. Yeah, I agree.
But to practice the everyday... the everyday religious function. It's a little difficult for people because they don't even know why or wherefore they do it.
You have to want to do it. Once you want to do it, it's not hard.